Evening and welcome. As you are no doubt aware, the nation is at present awash in champagne and gay with buntings in celebration of 50 years of broadcasting. Bonfires glow from every hilltop. People dance in the streets. Well, that's the background and the setting to tonight's extra special edition of my show. Looking back over 50 years of broadcasting, wading through the BBC archives, we picked out several people from the past and invited them to participate in tonight's show. Now, these are the beloved names of broadcasting, the people whose voices became as familiar to millions of people as their own front door. Anyway, without more ado, let me name just a few of the voices you'll hear tonight. They are, in order of size, Henry Crun, Minnie Bannister, Colonel Bludnock, Eccles, Neddy Seagoon, and many more. Brought to you by those three anonymous gentlemen who, for years, have so selflessly sacrificed their real selves in the cause of art. Tonight, I can reveal they are Peter Sellers, Spike Milligan, and Harry Secombe. I shall make the introductions in order of waist measurements. Ladies and gentlemen, Harry Secombe.
Hello! Word up, look at that.
Harry, when can you remember when you first made people laugh?
Yes, I suppose it was in a church social, you know. Because when I was a lad, most of the social activity was centered around the church. Yeah. And I was a sort of a community idiot. Yeah, I was to make myself laugh and everybody else.
And they used to invite you along for to make people laugh, didn't you?
Yes, when we had church socials and sort of outings, and I was always the one who did impressions of the vicar.
Yeah.
Vicar didn't like it. Yeah.
Have you always found that wherever you go, whichever situation you're in, that you make people laugh? I mean, for instance, you were in the army, weren't you?
Yes, on your side.
On our side.
Yes.
But was that a kind of rich area for...
It was a great place because there's so many things happen in the army, so many things go wrong, you know. And I remember once being marched off parade in Aldershot. There's a bloke in front of me. We're on, being inspected by the GOAC. GOAC? GOC. GOAC, the GOC. GOC. Of Southern Command. We're all lined up in open ranks, you see, for inspection. And this fellow was standing at ease. And he had a very thin neck, and his battle dress, his overcoat was like that, you know, with a big gap there. And he had his fore and aft, his forage cap, right on like that. And there was a big dent in there, and it was pouring with rain, and this thing was filling up with water. And I could see it all happening behind him, and I'm going, trying not to laugh. So when they said, "Tension," he came to attention when I got all the way down his neck. And I went, hysterics! I was marched off the parade ground.
Were you constantly in trouble in the army?
Well, yes. I remember once we were on guard duty, and they'd taken our. 1940 it was, before your time. 1940. And they made me, I was a lance bombardier. It was a mistake, but I was a lance bombardier. And they made me sort of marching, in charge of marching reliefs outside a tent. We were in a tent, but I was outside. They wouldn't let me inside. And there was a lake in front of us, and there was this tent. And they'd taken our rifles away, the Lee Enfield rifles, and given us Ross rifles, Canadian Ross rifles, which had no cutout, which means you put the magazine in with the Ross, with an Enfield. Are you still with us? You put the magazine in the rifle, and with a Lee Enfield, you could put a cutout there. So when you put the bolt to fire the trigger, nothing went up the spout. So, bearing this in mind, Gene, they give us this. We only had one magazine between the lot of us, so that I had to take the rifle off the fella who was coming off guard, the next one on guard, and I put the ceremoniously put the magazine in, put the bolt forward. Pulled the trigger and blew a hole through the tent. And it missed a fellow by about that much. We ran into the lake and broke a toe on the Molotov cocktail. That was a shot.
I think you made that up.
No, but what about that? Yes. Bellamore Park outside Rugeley. Mm. Ask the lads, they're right in.
Because you had something happen to you in the army, apart from shooting people. You met Spike Milligan, didn't you?
I did, Joe. Yeah. That was that's a long story. Make it very quick.
Yeah.
Yes.
Take
your
time.
Anyway.
Hello, mate.
We're positioned in North Africa, up on a plateau near the Shawash Valley. I've got a memory for names, you know. I don't know where it was, but it was called the Shawash Valley. And there was this plateau thing, and we couldn't get the Germans out of these hills. We kept sending them letters, but they wouldn't go, you know. Come out, and they wouldn't. So they sent for these big guns. I was 25 pounder regiment, by the way, artillery. You know, they 5 mile snipers, they called us. After lead retreats, you know. I was wearing my uniform back to front. Well, I was advancing, but I was begging for the mappy. We had these gun pits they dug, you see. Our gun pits weren't big enough for this big 7.2 gun howitzer they sent up from Algiers to get the Germans out. You know, make a big visiting card. So they came in at what's called a night occupation, and they went in the gun pit we dug for them, and they went in on the top of this plateau. And I was in a command post at the bottom of a 150-foot cliff here. So anyway, they fired this first round with this big gun at night, and the sergeant said, fire, pull the lanyard away, turn on, the gun had gone. This huge gun had jumped out of the gun pit, and it came clattering over where we were and missed us by a few yards, you know, this little truck. And I thought, they're throwing guns at us. So nobody knew what had happened, you see. So the next thing we knew, the back of the truck parted the canopy, and the face came through. Anybody seen a gun? And it was Milligan, because he was on the crew with a girl, and he says he's still paying for it.
Was it the start of the goons then, Harry?
Well, I met him later in Italy, where we were on a thing called Settled Pool of Artists outside Naples, and I met him there, and we had this marvelous reunion. You know, there's this terrible sense of humour that nobody else really understood. Yeah. And we did a show called Over the Page. Terrible it was. We used to get hysterical. And when I came out of the army, I went to the Wimble Theatre, where I met Mike Benteen. He was half of an act called Sherwood and Forrest. Sherwood and Forrest.
That one out.
He was actually Forrest, because there was a bloke called Michael Sherwood who played the piano, or Tony Sherwood played the piano. And I introduced Spike to Mike, and then later we met Peter, and that's how it all started.
You were saying that not many people understood his kind of humour, that kind of zany humour. In fact, I remember when the Goon started, that people were reading all kinds of intellectual things into your humour, weren't they?
Oh, yes.
Shades
Kafka.
Of Inesco. Yes, Kafka,
and Dylan Thomas. Yeah.
But what was it to you, though, at that time? I mean, you know, what did you think you were creating?
Well, we were, first of all, against most of the established kind of humour that was existing at the time, you know, the hat turn up in the front, the I say, if anything happened to me, or the routine of gags thing, and probably because we couldn't tell jokes very well, I could never remember the endings. So I did a shaving routine, the way different people shave, but that was my act.
This is when you were on the holes?
Yes, around the holes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I could take off the bill at Bolton.
Why?
The manager came up to me and said, you're not shaving my bloody time. He said, and I was playing off of the Monday Night First House. So I sent a telegram to Mike Benteen. Audience with me all the way. Managed to shake him off at the station.
What was it like, Harry, that period on the halls when you were doing a solo spot? Was it,
well, it's a bit frightening, you know, because you're there and the dancing girls go on, eh, a bit of a routine. But then you're on, and it's all teeth caught. Hello, folks! all the eye flickering. Especially Monday Night First House in the winter, where you play Blackpool in the winter. You know, there's nobody out there except the landladies or something.
Yeah.
And they're all on the, you know, they're all on the Wilkie Bar. They're all coming for nothing.
Yeah.
And to get them going for 8, I've got to stay there for 8 minutes to get them going before the next act comes on.
Yeah.
And I once came on with a shaving act at Huddersfield, I think. I put my little table down with all the thing on it, and started, everybody has to shave, and I said, the table moved away, the rake of the stage was like that, and everything fell out of the orchestra. I don't know what to do, you know, nothing left, it was my act. So I went, and ad-libbed.
But I was talking to Peter earlier, and he was saying that one thing about you was that whereas if the others died on stage, as they did occasionally, you could always burst into song.
Yes, I was always lucky there.
Yeah.
Got the old truss on, and going, the tenor's friend. Yes.
Well, I trusted a tenor friend. Yes. Your description.
Yes, on the baritone's buddy.
But when did you? I mean, did you ever consider a serious career in singing at all?
No, I saw myself in tights once. I don't think it's opera was quite favourable. My knees haven't been orchestrated, you see. But I... and nothing else has either. I started singing because of the way comic can get off. You know, I think you did a monologue and I couldn't do those very well. So I used to finish up with Falling in Love with Love or Be My Love or something. In the wrong key, usually. I used to change key about three times in the middle. Somebody said to me, you know, it's all right having a voice, but you should do something with it, like lose it or get it or get it trained. So I went to a singing teacher, and for 12 years I studied very seriously.
Really?
The trouble was I used to go cross-eyed in the middle of an aria, and the publishers didn't like that. And I was singing to a wonderful man, De Verily. He said to me, Harry, he said, the composer, he said, you might have been up all night over his, just this little piece you're singing. He said, take him seriously. And then I began to take the whole thing seriously. I go cross-eyed at the end. But I do like singing very much, but I like to mix it with comedy. I think it's one complements the other as far as I'm concerned. That's why I've been very happy doing musical comedies. You know?
Yes. Going back to the Goons for a moment, Harry. Do you... I mean, everybody's got their idea. I mean, people like me were sort of reared on the Goons. We all had our own sort of visions of who the characters were. Were they, in fact, real life to you? Did you know them all personally?
Oh, yes, I think so, definitely. I mean, we used to sit around and talk about them, and a lot of the characters evolved from real characters.
Really?
Yes. Peter, you know, all the voices he has, he'd come in with something, perhaps car salesman he'd met, and he'd have his voice, which would develop into somebody else. It's in the very beginning, I mean. And Spike had his funny voices. I was generally Neddy because anything else I did still sounded like me, you know. Hello, Fox! One of those laser beam voices.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of them were built on real life characters. Like Peter, who provided most of the voices, let's face it. Peter had heard people, had seen them, and the most wonderful thing about Peter, when he's doing the show, standing next to him, he'd be Bloodnock. You know, he'd changed from being Bloodnock to Henry Crumb, and he actually was them, quite frankly.
Yes, so we'll probably see him. You better be careful what you say is going on in a moment.
Oh, I love him!
Did you, when you went back and did this special show for the 50th anniversary, what was it like, Harry? Was it terribly nostalgic? Did it work again, the magic? Or
well, we'd all laughed ourselves hysterically and thought about it beforehand, and then when the day came, I think the three of us were apprehensive and a bit nervous about it, because it's nearly 12 years before we, you know, since we did the last one. And as you know, so much of it depended on fairly split-second timing and knowing what the other fellow's going to say or anticipating what he's going to say so he can come in with the next thing. But suddenly we turned up at the Camden Theatre. Nothing had changed. They were the same cups and saucers hanging about. the same people. And suddenly it really was there, you know. And Ray Ellington, all the boys, and Max. It was wonderful.
Mm.
And suddenly the magic. It didn't. It straight away started like a leg has gone to sleep. You slap it a bit, and suddenly it comes back.
Yes. Did you? Were you aware at the time though, when you were first doing the Goon Show, that in fact you were creating a style of humour, which I suppose was the most important innovation of being a humour this century?
I don't think we were. I think, I mean, Spike, for example, said, "Let's." We were doing other shows at the time. Peter, for example, was doing Raise a Laugh, and I was doing Educating Archie at one time when we were doing the Goon Show as well. And they were full of catchphrases. And Spike decided once, let's have a catchphrase. So he made up, I think it was Ying Tong Idle Hai Po, which means nothing. And then within weeks, people were saying Ying Tong Idle Hai Po on the street. And I think it frightened us a bit.
Harry, we're near the end of our time. I'd just like to ask you, do you find it tiresome at times, being expected to make people laugh?
No, I don't think so. I think, like most... something once called me a roly-poly extrovert. I suppose that sounds good, as near as anything. I think I get a kick out of making people laugh, and I find it more difficult to be serious. I mean, I find it more wearying, more tiring to be serious than it is to be funny.
Yes.
I don't know why. Perhaps I'm even working out.
Yeah.
I must get cracking on that.
You must, yeah, because it's true, isn't it, that in your profession, you're the professional funny man, but in recent years we've had this come to some very tragic figures, haven't we? People who were very funny on the stage and off stage had very tortured lives.
Yes, I think that's because a lot of them were intro extroverts and were more had to put on funny bits and were essentially serious-minded people, you know, take their art very seriously, and strive for perfection all the time, like Tony did, Tony Hancock. He was always self-searching and self-analytical, always looking for something inside himself. Well, I accept what I am, you know, for better or for worse, and try not to analyze myself or whatever I've got that makes other people laugh. You know, it's so intangible, you know, leave it alone. Thank God for it.
That's so sad.
Yeah, yes.
Harry, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, my next guest made his name as a goon and went on to become a great superstar. For a while, he was considered as someone with a remarkable gift for mimicry. But as his career in films progressed, he revealed in movies like Dr. Strangelove, Lolita, The Pink Panther, and many others, that he was an actor of real genius. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Sellers.
It occurs to me that the art of impersonation is sort of carrying it through, isn't it? You know, it's going out there and carrying through with it no matter what. Can you remember the first time, Peter, that you ever impersonated anybody?
Yes, I think it was basically when I was at school, but I used to do impersonations in the RAF a bit and whatnot, and play drums and lark around generally. I used to impersonate anybody and anything I could find, mainly officers.
Now, there must be a rich source of inspiration.
Yes,
there
were. That's where Bloodknot came from originally.
Really?
Spike was born in India, as you know, in Quetta. And I spent about 3 years out there during the war. And I met a lot of people and of this sort. Bloodknot, who do anything to anyone, and they don't care, you see. And one night I remember we were in Agartala in Assam, and it was Christmas Eve, and I never spent Christmas Eve in a hot country, and I was far away from home, and I was thinking, my mum wants me at home. Now, you know how you get... There's some terrible old wog... Oh, I beg your pardon.
I didn't mean that.
Stuff they used to drink out there called Rosa rum, you see. And in those days, we were sort of drinking a bit, you know. That's all we don't drink anymore, of course. Wine, you know. And I remember getting very drunk and watching a similar thing. You see, we used to wear bush hats, you know, some of the time. And you remember Harry was telling you earlier about the fellow on his forage cap?
Yeah.
I was sitting on my charp on this bed, this charpoy, and this fellow was sitting opposite me with a mug of Rosa rum. And, you know, they come up at the side, like they have a little button there, you can clip them, or you can leave them down, like Aussies clip them up, you know.
Right.
And he was pouring this rum and letting it sort of, trying to make a lake around the middle of my hat. And I thought, I'm a twit to sit here and do this when I could be in the officer's mess. What am I doing here, you see? So I found some officer's insignia, air commodores, and put some blanket on, wandered into the officer's mess. It'd be about 3 a.m. now. There was only one lone old twit in there sitting in the corner. And he looked at me. And as far as I can recall, he said, what are you doing here? Because he said, they all sounded like Bloodknot. I said, Air Minister is our welfare. I just said, and I was really gone. He said, good Lord, you're frightfully young for an air commodore. You're young to have white hair, too. I said, can you see that room? He said, yes, I see in the dark, you know. It's all this rum. So, it was dark, actually. And I thought, hello, he's going to rumble me any minute. I'm going to be in the old thing. I think it'll be away the next day. And that was, I used to do things like, terrible things like that, and getting into the old sergeant's mess there, and all kinds of terrible impersonations of that sort.
Well, what about this guest, though, Peter, of picking up a person's voice, imitating it? Do you have to listen to it for a long time, or is it like some instant feedback with you, that somebody says something to you and you pick it back, pick it up immediately?
Well, I spend a lot of time, like, listening to people talking. That's why I'm usually considered to be very dull company at parties, you know, because I try and get people chatting, so if I find somebody who's interesting and I sort of beam in on them and say, oh really, you know, tell me more about that, and get them chatting. If I find that there's something interesting about them, or there's some sort of idiosyncrasy that I might be able to put in my little sort of filing index and think, well, I could use that later, One impersonation, because he used to do impersonations, you know, when we were both at the Windmill, you know. Yeah. And that time I was doing impersonation, I'd given up the old drums, you know. Had to. I used to be a drummer, did you know?
Well, I knew you were going to be, I knew you were a drummer. I was going to ask you about that. Why, in fact, did you give up the musician's life?
Skin trouble.
Yes. You're right. You didn't have plastic heads in there. No, a terrible thing happened. You see, we used to do these one-night stands, and everyone used to, all musicians stand around Archer Street, you know.
Yeah.
And loads of drummers were demobbed after the war, you see, and, you know, everyone was getting work but me. And I was a good drummer, actually, you know, in those days. I mean, you know, not now, but... and we got a gig. I was playing with a little group called the Jive Bombers. Of course, this was 1949, of course, and that was, you know, sort of an in-word then, you know. And... we played up in Birmingham, and I went up with a saxophone player because he, you know, got this. I hadn't got a car, and I put my kit in his car, you know. And we were playing at the town hall, and there was, I don't know if you've noticed, but people seem to congregate, certain sort of spotty hair, but seems to congregate around drums. Mm. And they stand watching you and go, or make drum sounds, you know. And eventually, you remember Flanagan and Allen, don't you?
Oh,
with and the sort of song that you sing, any underneath the arches, or any umbrellas, you know. And they're very lilting, sort of, you know, lullaby type songs, which they used to, they made very famous and very popular. But we didn't play that sort of music. You see, we played sort of, you know, I don't know, Sid Phillips arrangements and whatnot. I don't know. Anyway. This fellow said to me, he'd been watching me for about half an hour, and he says, "Osai," and this is why I actually packed in drumming, the real truth, you see. He says, "Osai, Mike, can you all play any umbrellas?" So, you know, sort of, you know, and it's really boring, you know, at about, you're playing the same bloody thing, you know, all the time. And, you know, trying to keep tempo, because, you know, they're very hot, especially the old people. If your tempo is not so hot, they come, you know, and start having a go at you, you know.
You're playing that now.
They fall down.
Yes, they fall down.
Get a rhythm drummer.
Anyway, this fella, he said to me, he says, "Oh, Si, can you play any umbrellas?" I said, no, we don't play that. He says, "Why don't you play it?" I was getting a needle by this time. I said, "Just because we don't play it, mate, that's all." So he looked at me, he says, "Shit face," and walked away. He said, I thought, that's it, isn't it? I'm finished, you know, I'm out.
That's a pungent criticism, isn't it?
Pungent criticism. So I thought, I much need this for the rest of my life. So that's how I get in the windmill.
And you're mentioning about the impersonation you did there, which you prefaced that story about. Well, what were the impersonations you did then, Peter?
I used to do one of, the one I can still do, of Alec Guinness. I don't mean Alec Guinness.
Oh, yeah, Guinness.
This is from Kind Hearts and Coronets, where he plays the old preacher. I remember when I first met him, incidentally, because that was one of my favourite films. He was an idol, and still is an idol of mine. I don't know how many idols I have got, but... I'm dead idol, yes. And I was at Bone Idol, there's another one, yes. Yes, Idol Jack, we did. Anyone want to see my son Aladdin?
Now then, if you see Aladdin, come on, shout out, let's know.
What was it? They always used to have my... This is interior, but they always used to do this thing. They used to stand at the side like that and look upstairs, didn't they? Oh, yes, the day. You know. I don't know why. It was sort of a ritual. Alec Guinness. To Dennis Price. "My west window has all the elegance of Chaucer, with none of the concomitant crudities of the period." Talking variety, Bill, and what you said earlier, you know, dear, how many times he saved our life, because Milligan and I used to die regularly. Oh, no.
This is when the Goons were touring the halls.
Well, yes, but not very often, was it?
What? The horse? Oh, well, I don't know. Forget Coventry. What? You forgot Coventry?
No, I haven't.
Oh, wow.
Well, I'll tell you, this Pike jumped in his trumpet there and said something rather strange.
Yes, he says, "You hate me, don't you?" to the audience.
Yes.
And it was a bad night for Milligan. It was a bad night for me. And even his comedy went bad, but he got the song at the end.
Oh,
he did the old song.
Singing Jim.
And you could feel waves of hate coming up. But, I mean, many times, you know, Milligan and I have been, like, sort of paid off, and he said, OK, if they go, I go. So they've kept us on. So, we sort of had work for the rest of the week.
Yeah. I always remember you at Coventry, though. You came on just before Christmas. It was in the evening show, and you weren't all that happy with the audience. So you came on with a chair, as I remember, and you sat down. You said, I've been shopping, and I've just bought a little EP of Christmas songs I thought you might like to hear. You remember that?
Oh, that's right, yes.
And he said, I thought you might like to hear it. So he motioned to the electrician who put the record on, and he just sat there while this EP played. And at the end, they floored it.
He went better than I did. At the end, they were shrieking for more. And this man, God rest his soul, is dead now, but he's a manager called George.
You have a little strange voice like that, careful manager. I came off and said, what the bloody hell do you think you're doing?
So I said, what do you mean?
He said, you're not doing, you can't do that. And
I said, it's better than my act's ever gone, you know. I mean, listen to that, they love them more, shouting for more. And if I had another record, I'd go on again. So he gave me the sack on the spot, and Harry came up and saved me bacon. And we've had some marvellous times. Yes,
we have. I give Spike out to play his trumpet for the second half of the show, and he'd jump at his trumpet, you know, the first half of the show, and we'd open the second half with these stack and stick dancers.
Yes.
There were 2 minutes outside, all dressed like idiots with bells on.
Yes.
Trying to get him out of there. He can come out, I don't know, you try, you know.
He got me out of a wallet that night over the OP mints here, and this left eye, prompt mince, sorry, and mince pie, prompt mince pie. It got it.
Yeah,
right. Do you know about that? Oh, there's not many people know that. Do you know?
What's that?
This is my Michael Caine impression. Do you know that it takes a man to fall from the top of Big Ben? See, Mike's always quoting from the Guinness Book of Records. Doesn't matter, at the drop of a hat, he'll trot one out, you see. It takes a man in a tweed suit 5.5 seconds to fall from the top of Big Ben to the ground. Now, there's not many people know that.
It's a real conversation stopper, isn't it?
You know? Oh, yeah. He's got loads of them. Massive of
them. Must be a gas of the party.
Oh, he is, yeah. He really is, yeah.
We keep mentioning Spike, don't we? And he's in Australia, of course. But I've got to tell you that we've been in contact with him, and he sent a message to you on the programme.
Oh.
So if you can listen, we shall hear the Milligan, or Milignar.
yes.
From Australia.
Hello, from sunny Australia. For I'm in bed with pneumonia. It's great fun, microphone. It's great fun being on the Michael Parkinson Show for unemployed actors. First, I want to say hello to 23 stone Harry Seeker. Hello, 23 stone Harry Seeker. Friend, father, and sex maniac. Practicing sex maniac. Practice makes perfect. It makes perfect sex maniac. And greetings to aircraftsman Peter Sodlers, the well-known printing error. Talking to your doctor about your trouble, Pete, and he says, stop it or you'll go blind. We don't get the Michael Parkinson Show in Australia. And that's why I'm here. Last year, thanks to you, Michael, immigration from England was the highest ever. Harry and Peter, you'll be glad to know, they have a goon show out here. It's called the British Embassy. Well, that's all from sunny Sydney Prison Hospital. And now, farewell with an old Australian bush song. Oh, there was a little fly, lived in a grocery store, and he on the ceiling, and he on the floor, he on the bacon, and he on the jam, and he on the head of the little grocer man. Now the little grocer man got out his frying gun. He should hug that fly before the day is done. But before he could count from 1 to 10, the little fly went bye-bye, England. Bye-bye, Harry and Peter and Michael. Good luck out there in the old land, he's lying. How I am.
I didn't know he was going to do that one.
It's very rude, isn't it?
Yes, it is rude.
Oh, yes, rude.
It's rude. It's rude, mate.
Very funny, isn't it? Mm.
Oh. Did you? yes, we should all have a small rest now. That reminded one of the sort of flavour that used to go into the Goo Show so much. Did you always have the full cooperation with the BBC, or did they attack you a little worried by you?
Yeah, they were mainly worried. Yes, you see, because we'd slip things in, and like we used to have two outside commentators, Peter and Hugh Jampton, who used to sort of give commentaries from the top of St. Paul's or anywhere, and they'd say, over now to Hugh Jampton on top of St. Paul's. And he'd say, well, here from my vantage point on top of St. Paul's, I can see the household cavalry, so called because each member is a householder, and coming towards us on now, any moment now, and this sort of thing. But nobody knew that Hugh Jampton was Cockney rhyming slang for something else, you see.
Fancy that.
As the actress said, well, that's out, I know. Anyway, never mind.
Well, you did use the payoffs of rather naughty army jokes, didn't we? You know.
Oh, yeah.
Just the payoffs. And to the pure, all things were pure. But we used to get complaints from old ladies in Cheltenham, didn't we?
Yeah.
We shouldn't have known the joke in the first place.
Yes, how did they ever know? But they used to come along, you see, about 3 weeks later, Mike, and say, you can't do that on the air. And we said, we've already done it, you see, that's the point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we used to get away with it, you know, craftily that way. But there was an eternal sort of fight, really.
Yeah.
Until they began to realise that people weren't at all bothered by it and enjoyed in the main listening to, because we had we built up eventually to a very big listening figure.
Oh, fantastic.
Know.
I mean, quite extraordinary. It became a cult, in fact, didn't it?
Yeah.
And still is, really. You know, among a certain sort of generation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think, you know, really, that, like, things that we admire, like Monty Python, etc., etc., and Beyond the Fringe, and all the boys in the late night satire, and John Wells, etc., I think they were also. Peel and John Miller all feel the same about going humour, that they were sort of weaned in a way on it.
They were.
You know?
They were young then, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. No, like us, dear.
Just like us, dear.
Milligan says, what does Milligan say in there about you? He says a lot. That's our book.
That's
a
good,
yes, very funny book.
Yeah. Before we look at that,
really though,
for a moment, Harry was saying earlier, Peter, that when you did the recordings of the Goons in the studio, that you actually became these characters, Cron and people like that. I mean, were they real to you? Could you put a face on them? And
yes, I think to all of us, you know, they absolutely lived. You know, they came about in various ways, as Harry was telling you. But I mean, one character, Ben Team, was forever telling people they were a genius. They were geniuses, you see. I don't know why he did this, but he'd say to anybody, you know, after a few minutes' conversation, you're a genius. And they usually believe it, because Ben Team, you know, is the only one who's had any real education out of the three of us. And he went to Eton, he's been to Eton, you know.
Oh, God.
Dude, just to do the drawings, Mike. But you.
But he was always telling.
He's lovely, all
he was, yes. But, oh, yeah. But, I mean, he was the one who sort of, you know, he'd studied nuclear physics and you know, all we could do was, you know, get through these three-letter words like cat and dog and it. This fella came over one evening, I'll never forget it. He was a tall and wide. He wasn't fat, but he was sort of wide. And he was dressed as a scout leader. In fact, he was a Boy Scout leader. Ben Team was appearing at Chiswick Empire, and I was at Shepherd's Bush Empire, which is now a BBC.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Anyway, the door opened, and the fellow said, there's some stranger, geezer out here. Well, I don't know what he says. Michael Benteen sent him along, so I thought, well, I might as well see him, you see. So, anyway, this tall fellow, he got a little briefcase, and he got a scout hat, but he got a big red beard with all this, and red knees and socks, and all the insignia, you know. And he said,
And I'm not kidding, this is how he spoke. He said, could I come in for a moment, please? No. And I thought, what is this? Is this? So I said, yes, certainly, please. What can I do for you? He said, Maka, I have just seen Maka Benteen at Chiswick. And he said that I'm a genius.
He must be sent from heaven, Peter.
Yeah, he was, you see. Then he went on to ask me about doing a concert at the Solgrave Road Boys Club or something, you see. So I said, no, I don't think, it's like Saturday night. It was the last thing I really wanted to do at that stage, especially if he was an example of what I was going to find down there. So he said, he thought he took this as a hint. He said, there is a fee involved. So I said, no, it's not a question of money, I assure you. I would come, but I just can't, at the moment. So he stood there for a second. He said, oh, well, just a thought. He said, do you know anyone else I could see? So I sent him along with me. So he found our blue bottle.
That's amazing, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. You did a big falsetto. And I think we added a little bit to it, but I mean, it was mainly.
Well, let's have a look now. I mentioned earlier to both of you this occasion when you got together for the sort of 50th anniversary thing, and I did this special recording of the Goon Show, and we have got a clip of that occasion now, coming up in just a couple of seconds.
Echo?
Yeah?
It's me, Pin Button.
Oh, my friend!
Yes, I'm your friend. You remember me?
I remember you.
Yes. Why do you not open the door?
Okay, how do you open the door?
You turn the knob on your side.
I haven't got a knob on my side.
The door.
The door? Oh, I'll soon get the hang of that.
Echo.
What?
What is that sticking at the top of your boot wearing a cap?
That is my nephew, Little Jim.
Ah, hello, little Jim. Okay, I do not understand what he is saying.
Say that again, little Jim.
Okay.
He said he doesn't understand what he's saying either.
He's one of Mrs. Thatcher's incomprehensives. Here, who is that snoring in that frock?
It's Neddy. He thinks he's... He thinks he's the Queen of England.
Echo.
Yet.
Let us play a game and push him down the well.
Yeah.
He's falling in the water.
Obviously, there's a thing that comes across from that, just that brief clip, is that you have immense fun doing that. Is giggling ever a problem?
Yeah,
it might be. It's a customer. Originally, they couldn't edit it, could they? Because it was done on disc.
That's right, yes.
And it wasn't until the tape came in that we cut some of the giggles and rather dubious ad libs out.
Yeah. One used to read stories or hear stories about each doing terrible things to the other, as you. I mean, used to set fire to scripts and things, didn't you?
That's been known, yes. Which the goose the announcer, that was the worst thing.
And we'd look forward to, this incredible day, this Sunday, this sort of reunion, as it was for us.
Mm.
I mean, we used to live for that, didn't we? I mean, I did, and I know you didn't. Like,
I suppose Spike used to feel a bit weary because during the week he wrote most of it with Larry or on his own, maybe.
Well, Eric Sykes too. Well,
and Eric Sykes as well. And Eric, yes, Eric used to write several of the shows with Spike. And I think that the Sunday get-together used to sort of, you know, put a charge into Spike, and the thing used to get off the ground. We really had a marvellous time. It was probably, as I say, I think looking back, the most happy time professionally I've ever spent in my life.
Really? It might have.
You mentioned the Spike and writing stuff, and in fact there's a book out of Goon Show scripts written and selected by Spike, with drawings by the three of you. I tell you one thing that's in here that's very amusing, I find, as much as a script, and that's these extraordinary sound effects. And there's one marvellous one in here which says something like, noise of two hippos walking away or knocking into one another. If you can't get two hippos, two lions will do. But I mean, you used to do a lot of the sound effects on there, didn't you, Harry?
Well, no, I used to do the raspberries, some of the raspberries, and some of the story effects. I was good at that. But one thing, I remember Spike once wanted the effect of something being hit with a sock full of custard.
Oh, yes.
Remember that, man? And he got the lady at the canteen at the camping theatre to make him a custard, and she thought it was, he had a bad stomach. He's always
yes, that's right.
And she made this lovingly prepared this custard for him. She said, "Here you are, Spike, here's your custard, you know." As you think, he took his sock off and poured it in. You know?
Yeah.
And he went downstairs and he swung his sock round his head in against the wall. It didn't have the effect he wanted. It wasn't the effect.
Yeah.
So he had a sock full of custard and no effect.
How they ever did it, the effects boys.
It's so marvellous, wasn't it?
All producers and whatnot in their own right now.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But they used to, Spike used to pose the most difficult sounds to make, like a piano being played at high speed across the Atlantic, you know. I think.
There's some marvellous description there, Peter, to aren't there, of the characters.
Yeah, there's one especially, one of my favourites, Spike's description of Eccles, the original goon. Born 1863, only child of Ethel Cox, virgin. Educated at convent till age 7, end of education. Has had 18,312 interviews for jobs. Has never been employed. Spends his days walking around saying, "Hello, there," to anyone who will listen. Wears a 33-year-old Burton suit. Is occasionally used by Metropolitan Police for target practice. Was once painted by Augustus John from head to foot with whitewash. Likes children, children like him. His economy drives consist of wearing only one sock. Was the personal friend of a brewer's dray. Was Home Secretary for 3 days until printing error was discovered. Lives near 29 Scrot Lane, Balham. Clubs none. Recreations, walking around saying, "Hello, Dad," to anyone on this.
How about you, Harry?
Well, there's one here of Toulouse Moriarty of the House of Roland.
Oh, yeah.
French, Scrag, and Lackey the Gritpipe Thin. Born 1920 in Paris, educated Sorbonne and Saint-Cyr Military Academy. Captain French Moron racing car team at Brooklands, 1927. Became the Latin darling of the motoring set, lionized by London, seen at all smart places. The Café Royal, the Ritz, danced the tango all night long with Lady Astor, operation for piles. Wall Street crash, family fortune decimated. Started work as a gigolo at New Crom Palais de Danse. Was befriended by Hercules Gritpipe Finn, who offered to manage his career. Under Gritpipe's careful management, he is now bald, daft, deaf, and worthless. Currently working at a license as trainee corpse in Leith Crematorium. I'm hoping to play the lead in Jesus Christ Superstar, isn't it? Club Chateau Neuf, recreation trying to escape.
Let's have one more.
This is Spike's last description of mate. Oh, mate, he's called
great,
William Mate Cobblers. Drains clear, now you wait. I'd better do it in the voices.
Yeah, yeah.
Born Shoreditch 1900, son of Fred Chopper Cobblers, OBE, road sweeper, and Vera Collin. Matter of fact, Vera Collin appears on several other pages, so you've got a round of it, obviously.
Left school at 14, joined Thomas Crapper and Son as tea boy. Joined Chislehurst Laundry as tea boy. Joined Woolwich Arsenal as tea boy. Conscripted World War One as private sap as a miner's tea boy. Rose to rank of acting unpaid lance corporal, injured in action by tea urn falling on head. Discharged 1918, since when he's been wandering the streets telling motorists with no authority at all, you can't pot there, or put that cigarette out, or I don't know, I'm a stranger around here, or why don't you get your hair cut, or 2 years in the army are doing good, or bleeding foreigners, or I spent 4 years fighting for this country, mate. Now uniform, dormant at BBCA early and all, wears full war medals all times and King's badge for the disabled. Informs all visitors to BBC, it's nothing to do with me, mate.
It's absolutely brilliant, though. Sadly, we're toward the end of our programme, and I'd like to...
I just want to say thank you very, very much indeed. I really enjoyed that. That was absolutely marvellous, yeah. Wasn't it? Wasn't it great?
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having us. Well, absolutely marvellous. Oh,